Broadcasting from the Civic Cypher Studios, welcome to the QR Code, where we share perspective, seek understanding, and shape outcomes. I am Ramses Ja.
And I am Q Ward.
And we would like for you to stick around because we have another interesting show for you today. We're going to hopefully learn a lot of things. One of the things that we've been discussing on the show quite a bit, and one that we're looking forward to getting into the deep end, is whether or not Black people are a monolith. That is often used as talking points on the right. You know, Black people are not a monolith, and on the left. And then there are some people that are trying to reclaim the narrative that Black people are on the same page and there is a such black thing as Black unity. So we're going to see what that looks like. We're also going to be talking about reparations. This is not a topic that we've uncovered yet on the show. But we're going to look at it from a different perspective, because there are some people that did get reparations, not Black people, but there are some people that did. And I think that that makes for a great case precedent for folks who really don't know where they land insofar as the reparations conversation is concerned. Later in the show, we're going to take you inside the mind of the Black conservative. We have some data that really kind of identifies, you know, who a Black conservative is, what they value, how they move, and what they think of the world. And before we get there, we're going to start the show off with, you know, our culture segment as always. And we're going to compare race and culture. You know, the question was posed, you know, why are all the Black kids sitting together, you know, at the lunch table? Well, the answer is they're not sitting together because they're Black. It's because of a shared culture. We also have, of course, Q Ward's Clapback, and we have Better Do Better. A lot for you to stick around for. So a show full of content that we think you're going to enjoy. But as always, we like to start off with a feel-good feature. So today's feel-good feature comes from the Equal Justice Initiative. Shout out to Brian Stevenson, who is one of the great heroes to both myself and Q. It reads, the International Jury of the Stockholm Prize in Criminology Foundation has awarded the Stockholm Prize in Criminology to Francis Cook and EJI Director Brian Stevenson for their applied criminological research as practitioners who, quote, succeeded in reducing cruel and unusual punishment, unquote. The prize was presented by Her Majesty the Queen of Sweden at the Grand Prize Ceremony in Stockholm City Hall in conjunction with the Stockholm Criminology Symposium. The Stockholm Prize in Criminology is an international prize awarded for outstanding achievements in criminological research for the application of research results by practitioners of the reduction of crime and the advancement of human rights. Made up of internationally recognized scholars, law enforcement officials, and former prize recipients, the international jury selected Mr. Stevenson and Francis Cook, former CEO of the Howard League for Penal Reform, for their work applying research to reduce disproportionate punishments in the U.S. and the U.K. Mr. Stevenson was recognized for advocacy that has prevented many unjust executions and won a landmark ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court in Miller versus Alabama, barring mandatory sentences of life imprisonment without parole for children. Organized by Swedish National Council for Crime Prevention, this year's symposium focused on justice and rationality in correctional policies and practices. For those that are not familiar with Brian Stevenson, just know that he exists. And he and people like him are doing good work, taking baby steps, I will admit that, but steps nonetheless toward a more equitable and more just society for all of us. And we don't get a lot of good news these days, but when someone gets recognized for that type of work that they're doing, we like to take a moment and acknowledge them. So Brian Stevenson, shout out to you for our feel-good feature for today. So now the question, this is a question that's come up before between me and Q. Why are all the Black kids sitting together at the lunch table? This was funny when we got a chance to talk about it a while back. This has been some years now, but, you know, it came up again recently. And it's you hear the question posed, not just about Black kids, but, you know, why are the Black kids doing this? Or why are the Black kids doing that? Or why are the Hispanic kids always doing this? Or why do these folks dress like that? Or why do the white kids do this or whatever, right? Of course, in our world, it's very black and white. So we get approached, you know, from people that know the type of work we do, and they are perhaps legitimately curious, and they wonder these things, right? And, you know, we talk about church, we talk about, you know, all these cultural silos. And for folks that aren't intimately familiar with it, it seems like they're racial silos. It could seem like they're racial silos, right? And so differentiating race and culture is, I think, important for folks that might not regularly or might have never stopped to really appreciate the line that divides the two, okay? So here's a little bit of background on this particular question about the black kids sitting together at the lunch table, again, from Quora. But it was a question posed, and there's a decent response to it. So I figure I'll share it, just again, frame this conversation that you and I are about to have. The question goes, I saw black students sitting separately from white students in dining halls at the University of Delaware. Why was that? Do blacks feel ill at ease near whites? And then the response was from someone named Brother Nkosi. It says, I was also visiting that day at the university, and what I noticed was all the white kids sitting separate and apart from the black kids. Do white kids feel ill at ease around blacks? Historically, there is a group that has told another group that they could only sit in one area of the bus. Have told them to not eat in the same restaurant or use the same bathroom, et cetera, et cetera. Do black people have a history of that? It might have been a nice gesture considering that history for the white kids to come over and then invite the black kids to sit with them. Also, graciously understand if the black kids declined, because if those white kids had learned anything about black history while they were in high school, they would have came to the same conclusion that many black people have, that racial healing is a process, not an event. So to answer your question, given the historical relationship and current climate, maybe they did feel a little ill at ease. It's possible. Lastly, to be of most benefit to you, the question has to become, why did you feel the onus of mingling? Or why did you feel the onus of mingling was on them under the circumstances? If you can be honest with yourself as to the framing of the question, you will have moved forward as a person. So there's a lot there, but I want to add just a little bit more before we get to our back and forth cue. So I looked up the definition of culture just because I think it's going to help us out. So culture, the first definition says the arts and other manifestations of human intellectual achievement regarded collectively, okay? So arts and other manifestations, creations, et cetera, regarded collectively, okay? And then two, the customs, arts, social institutions, and achievements of a particular nation, people, or other social group. So Caribbean culture is a great example. And then we'll talk about race. Okay, the definition of race is each of the major groupings into which humankind is considered in various theories or contexts to be divided on the basis of physical characteristics or shared ancestry. Okay, it's not scientific, but you know, physical characteristics. Okay, so my half curly hair, if Q grows his hair out, looks similar to mine largely. We have brown skin, you know, that sort of thing. So race. There are people that are of the same race as me and Q and don't share the same culture as me and Q. Caribbean people is a great example, you know. I did not grow up as a Caribbean man. And so if I went to a lunchroom and there was a group of Caribbean people sitting together, they would be sitting according to their culture, not according to their race, right? And they'd be having conversations that are relevant. They'd be sharing jokes and sharing foods. And in an environment where they're comfortable among each other and not being judged by perhaps my American sensibilities, right? And there's the dividing line. Now, one of the things that happens often with non-black people entering into a lunchroom setting or some other equivalent setting is they'll see black people grouping together and they will feel excluded from that, right? And I want to say two things about that. Growing up black, living black my whole life, white folks, I cannot think of a single example ever in my life of black folks sitting together and saying, I'm so glad that no white people are sitting with us, right? That's not, white folks are not excluded from that. It's not a decision based on excluding people, but rather about finding people that you won't feel are judging you. Where if you do eat, remember we talked about eating a watermelon, eating a banana, these foods that we are very cognizant of, eating a piece of fried chicken, you don't feel the gaze, you don't feel the judgment, you don't feel like you're letting down your ancestors, you know what I mean? So you just find folks who you're comfortable with. And it's not just what your food you're eating, but a whole host of things. The other thing is, again, I think the article or the response says it best. It is not impossible. It is not frowned upon to go and make a new friend, right? I'm Ramses Jawaruddy King Taylor II. That is who I am, right? I was born in Compton, California in 1982, okay? The whole time I've lived in these United States of America, and the whole time I knew that life was better for white folks, and that white folks have regarded black people in a different way than we regard ourselves, right? However, whatever that means to you, if you're listening, whatever that means to you, there is a distinction between how white folks regard us and how we regard ourselves, okay? If that's fair, if you'll allow me that, then the rest of this makes sense. So knowing that these folks have the capacity, the potential, maybe there's a likelihood that they would judge me, that I might embarrass them, bring shame to them, they don't want to sit with me, knowing that that is even a possibility, given the history of this country, given my own personal treatment, given what I've known from TV, what I know from police, what are my own apertures into my reality. If I'm looking for the most comfortable place to sit in a room where I'm not going to ruffle any feathers, not going to upset anybody, well, I know that the people that look like me aren't going to regard me in a way that is going to be damaging to me, and I'm not going to be damaging to them. And it's easy to find comfort there. And it's not necessarily because of how they look, not because of their racial composition. It's just that's one way of determining whether or not they share the same culture as me. So hopefully that frames it, but you're always welcome to come and say hi. I don't ever want anybody to feel like you can't come say hi or you can't come sit with us. We have never had that energy. That's always been something that has come from the other side. Okay, you're always welcome to sit. You can be our brothers. You might have to learn a couple of things, but we got you. I know I talked a lot, Q, but you know, it's on you. My bad, I do it a lot.
I chuckle every time you do that. We have a 10-minute segment. Rams will talk 9 minutes and 30 seconds. My bad, dog, what you got? Black people's culture was mostly stolen from us.
Sure.
I had to learn this in one of the most embarrassing ways possible. Sitting at dinner in Barcelona with a group of friends and being asked where I was from, I responded, Detroit. And I saw confusion on the face of the people at the table as they followed that question up like, no, where's your family from? To which I responded, Georgia, my mother from Macon, Georgia. And again, one of them asked if I meant Georgia like Eastern Europe. And I said, no, I mean Georgia like Atlanta, like the dirty South. And one person at the table realized that I didn't understand the question. And he rubbed his fingers on his arm to show the brown skin and asked me again where I was from. And I realized in that moment of the 12 or 13 people at the table, the only person that couldn't answer the question, where are you from, was me. And for Black Americans, that for so many of us is a question that we can't answer. You know, so our culture and our ethnicity being replaced by the systemic thing that we do over here called race, a social construct that doesn't mean what you think it means. Because there's a singular race of Homo sapiens sapien, and that's human. So, you know, here we are at that nexus point again.
Well, I think that brings us neatly to the next question. People have opinions on this, whether or not Black people are a monolith, right? So this is something that comes up every 4 years and probably during midterms when people try to figure out how the Black vote is going to go. And, you know, folks will say, well, you know, Black folks are not a monolith. They don't all just do the same thing, right? And, you know, there have been calls since I was little for Black unity, you know, talking like the early 90s, think like 92. I mean, there's been calls since before then, but, you know, this is when I started to click on and started to make heads or tails of the world. And there was this notion that there was no such thing as black unity, and that was kind of the great test of our generation, was to work on creating a more unified front for our people. But bear in mind, this was also the time of the Million Man March. This was also the time of, you know, the black medallions, or the Africa medallions, and, the cross colors type clothes, and, all that sort of stuff, right? And, most recently, I had a conversation with Dr. Christopher Towler from, I think it's UC Santa Barbara is where he's based, if I'm not mistaken. But Dr. Towler, he is the head of the Black Voter Project, right? So what they do is they monitor trends for black voters around the United States. They use larger sample sizes than, your typical research groups, because they're focused on really one community and kind of identifying the trends within that one community. So the data in their estimation is more accurate because it's exclusive to this one group and it's a larger sample size. And, I asked him about, whether or not black people were a monolith, whether black people are on the same page insofar as our politics are concerned. Are we aligned in that way? And the conversation that he had with me, based on the most recent election results, suggested that, yes, black people were largely in alignment. There was over 90% of black women that voted the same way, over 80% of black men that voted the same way. In a country this size with, as near as it makes no difference, 40 million may as well be black folks in this country. To get those huge majorities on the same page about their politics is about as close to being on the same page as you're going to get, right? So for the people that, have one set of optics on whether or not black folks are a monolith and whether or not that's a good thing, you can draw your own conclusions. For people that have the opposing view and the opposing optics and feel like it means something entirely different, the numbers are the same nonetheless. What are you thinking, Q?
Well, I don't want to lead the witness, but as objective as data and numbers are, they can be used in a way that's very subjective.
Okay.
So yes, a very, very high percentage of the black people that voted seem to vote the same way.
Okay.
But what we know from that same data set is that less black people turned out than in the prior presidential election.
Okay, that's fair.
And that's where that monolithic conclusion can be a little slighted.
Mm-hmm.
When asked, are black people a monolith? People tend to resoundingly and proudly scream no, as if any ethnic group, when based on the nuance of daily life, taste in food, taste in music, taste in art, are the same. Like, no groups are monolithic in that way. The disadvantage that we have is we go out of our way to prove that we are not monolithic at all. And I say out of our way to prove it as if it's not in a lot of cases true. There's a thing that happens in organized labor where if there are some people that are part of that union that are having their needs met, they start to care a little less about those that are not, right? So that tends to be the ones who earn on the higher end of the spectrum. Right, you can create a situation where there is no cap for how much they can earn, but also no floor, no minimum for those that are beneath them. In that case, you are doing the work of those you are organizing against. Hey, that's not up to me. I'm not going to fight for the bottom to be raised because that might make them put a cap on the top. So I'm not going to participate in that at all. And that weakens your union in a way that kind of keeps you where you are without being able to make much progress. Even in situations where you've brokered some type of profit share, keeping your bottom so low so that you can have an infinite top, which is an imagination, because the ones who own the place are never going to let you earn more than them, is a good way to trick people. So that's the same thing that capitalism has done, in some cases, to black people, and not just capitalism. We talked about right-wing anti-intellectualism. We talked about the pandemic and the fear of the vaccine causing people to adopt a seemingly hyper-contrarian position with regards to all things moving forward, right? Everybody who stood in line with me, who agreed that we shouldn't get this shot, I guess I'm gonna just ride it out with them moving forward, even if that means becoming a Trump supporter. Because even though he was loudly against the vaccine, he was one of the first people to get it, which his supporters just very, very conveniently ignore. So are black people a monolith? Of course not. But those who look to oppress us, they're not a monolith either, except for when it comes to the idea of oppressing and staying ahead of us. They
Yes.
can disagree on 1,000 things. When election time comes, they find the singular thing that they agree upon and they vote based on that. And in this country, that thing is very, very loudly white supremacist Christian nationalism. Black people, we can agree on most things, and we will find the thing that we disagree about and create a disqualifier for each other, cannibalize each other, and splinter off into all these different fractions. And it makes it almost impossible for us to get ahead, because we are already not the majority. If you splinter us into fractions, it's impossible for us to really collectively get ahead. So I'm hoping at some point we can find a singular voice, or at least a singular group of things that we say we want, and kind of get out of this idea of cannibalizing and tearing each other down. Because we say we wanted all these things, and then we had a very, very overly qualified, brilliant black woman politician run for president who promised to give us almost all the things we wanted: jobs, housing, down payment assistance, like healthcare, support for black businesses, et cetera. And we just found things to pick her apart about while watching the other side prop up a 34-time convicted felon, adjudicated sexual assaulter, who was openly racist, openly anti-LGBTQ, openly anti-woman. It's really sad that we find ways to not become fist-like in our unity, while watching those who would have us never have anything or amount to anything, or never have just our self-determination, unite whenever they need to the tune of about close to 80 million, to put us in the position that we're in now. It's a really, really sad truth.
Well, if there's anything that we can take from it, because you're right, the couch was a definite factor in the last election. So using the data that we're using, it might not tell the complete story, but it doesn't say nothing, and that's not nothing. So I would argue that there is at least the potential for us to be on the same page, provided that we acknowledge that progress is a step-by-step process. It doesn't happen overnight. And that's a lesson that we're going to have to learn, I guess, in real time. Moving on. You know who better do better? The police. I mean, they always better do better, but today we're going to talk about why the police, like, the police don't need tanks. The militarization of the police. And this is something that, we've talked about before, Q. A lot of these things we talk about, from time to time because they come up. But, recently, there's been the reintroduction of this conversation. Like, where is all this equipment coming from? Why does it look like these people are soldiers going into a war zone, a guerrilla war zone? Aren't these supposed to be police? What happened to your friendly neighborhood police officer? Right? Oh, well, the state of the world has changed, you know, social media, all this sort of stuff. Well, no, you're supposed to hold the standard. You are the police. You know what I'm saying? But no, you know, the militarization of the police has made the world scarier than it needed to be. And yeah, the police, I think we've read this before, but the police, if the United States police departments collectively were a military organization, they'd be like the third largest military in the world behind the United States military and I think China's military, right? So the fact that they look like a military force complete with tanks and bulletproof and all this sort of stuff is wild. It's crazy work, right? So I'm going to share a bit from the Harvard Gazette. Issues revolve around culture, of viewing citizens as potential threats, concerns about self-protection and departments equipped with military-grade arms. Okay, that's the name of the article. All right, the mass shooting in Uvalde, Texas in 2022 by a gunman armed with an AR-15 style rifle resulted in a searing loss of life. 19 young students and two teachers at Robb Elementary School. But equally stunning was the 77 minutes it took police to respond, despite having adequate firepower, equipment, and training to do so. The delay turned a spotlight on the militarization of U.S. law enforcement, how it can fail to protect individuals from the kinds of threats it was intended to thwart, and its tendency to foster a culture of self-protection that can result in unnecessarily violent or deadly responses, particularly in communities of color, right? So the police are supposed to be all brave and bad, and they get the guns and the tanks and bulletproof vests and everything like that. And they always get to say that they feared for their life. And the people that they're supposed to be protecting, the citizens, they never get that benefit of the doubt. The issue, and that was me talking back to the article, sorry. The issue is complex, and many law enforcement departments across the country have continued to resist reforms, even amid a rising crisis of confidence in police and concerns over racism in the ranks. Jessica Katzenstein, an Inequality in America fellow who recently completed her PhD in anthropology at Brown, has been analyzing police militarization in an effort to show how and why departments are resisting changes in the ways the resistance is not as straightforward as it's often portrayed. Put simply, police militarization consists of a decades-old federal government practice making military equipment available to state and law enforcement agencies. The initial intent was to help arm police in the war on drugs and later to prevent terror attacks. Katzenstein said that many scholars argue that police militarization also includes SWAT teams, paramilitary teams and tactics, military bureaucracies, and militarized ways of understanding crime and criminality, in which the default is for officers to see non-officers as potential threats or enemies, a particular problem given that communities of color tend to be more heavily policed. Wow. During her field research, Katzenstein spoke with law enforcement officers, reform organizers, and others throughout Maryland about their views on militarization and proposed police reforms, such as the Baltimore Police Department's consent decree with reforms on training, bureaucratic organization, and compliant mechanisms. So that was just reading cue. Take it away.
I'm not sure where I would take it if I did take it away. There's something inherent about the police and the military in this country, and we spoke about it recently. And it's been like a hush thing that when you say it out loud, people treat you like you're race baiting or being extreme or being emotional, and they gaslight you like it's your imagination. But what we've always known about the police and even more scary about our military is that it still was created, all of it, to police, secure, and protect the wealthy of this country, right? Come and invade a place, take everything from everyone that is there, subjugate them, enslave them, unalive them, kidnap them, torture them, traffic them, take all of their belongings, establish a territory. And then create laws that make everything that you just did illegal so that they can't do it back. And then one at a time, as people break those laws, you arrest them and you do the whole thing all over again. So everything has always been for that same reason. So yes, they'll continue to give them tanks, guns, rockets, drones, airplanes, aircraft carriers, and whatever they need to continue to protect, serve, and guard, so that those in charge and in power will always remain so.